Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This is the second part of a two-parter with Baroness Helena Kennedy. There was just too much to cram into one part, so please enjoy more of her wonderful wit and repartee.
I was on the tube not very long ago, and I could feel somebody sitting to my left was looking at me, and so I turned around and she said, "Are you who I think you are?" And I said, and I hesitated for a minute, and I said, "Well, if you're thinking of killing your husband, I could be your woman."
Please remember to like, subscribe, and leave a review wherever you get your podcasts. Somebody said to me, I've got imposter syndrome. And I went, welcome to the club. I don't know anybody. And you know that we meet everybody from the biggest film stars in the world to lords and politicians all over the world. They're all the same, essentially. If you show me somebody who doesn't have that, I will show you a psychopath, to be honest with you, because it's a normal human nature to have a little bit of that. What we learn to do, and I think this is interesting for anybody listening, is how do you learn to overcome that so you don't show it too much in the world, so you can appear confident?
When I first started at the bar, I did feel, when I started going to law classes in my late teen, I was 18, everybody in my class was posh, and I thought they sounded just like the voices I used to hear on the radio growing up. And there's an interesting thing, which is that I made the assumption, and they were all men, and they were all boys, they were all young men who'd all gone to those very fancy schools, you know, and I assumed, because of their voices, that they were very clever. There's a certain kind of way of presenting, and their education had given them that confidence and that polish, which meant that they sounded intelligent even when, after a little while, you know, you'd listen and you'd start thinking, that was a really stupid thing to say. And so you started realizing that actually, in many ways, it was about a veneer and about being able to, if you speak in a confident enough way, whatever's going on inside, you can present it differently. And by watching this, I realized that actually, one of the things is about controlling your voice and being able to speak with authority and being confident enough to address a courtroom or an audience or whoever. And one of the things that I also have found, and this is an interesting thing, is that when I'm a King's Counsel now, actually. My QC overnight turned into King's Counsel. And once I became sort of prominent in my own profession and beyond, I realized that you're able to do things by looking somebody in the eye and not feeling somehow that their wealth, for example. I've had to raise money. When I was heading up an Oxford college, I wanted to create an Institute of Human Rights at Oxford, because I felt, you know, if the major institutions like Oxford and Cambridge had human rights institutes, then they were bedded into our systems and it would protect human rights in a way that it was an accepted thing as part of the of law. And so I started trying to raise the money, and it was going to, and in the end, I had to raise £25 million to build this building and then to create an endowment to pay the salaries of the director and so on. And And so in talking to people about money, it's very important that you can look them in the eye and that you are not intimidated by somebody being very rich. And Glasgow, I think, and the whole business of that Glasgow way of being, of humor, seeing humor in things, was that I was able to ask people for serious sums of money because I wasn't overwhelmed by the fact of money. And I think that learning that in life is a very important thing. The fact that people become well known or become rich or whatever, it shouldn't make you imagine that they're any different from anybody else. And if you can talk to them about the important things in life and the things that really matter, they know about that too. And so it is one of those important things. And to not be overwhelmed by the fact that someone's well known, they underneath they're feeling all the same sort of stuff as you.
That's a really interesting thing, is that I actually think that when you get well known, what happens is other people change and you don't. But as a result of other people changing, you start to go, oh, is it? So that ability to connect with humour, to do that bonding with humour, I think becomes vital in order to get to whether you're actually playing up or playing down in the social strata. It becomes the vital connection whereby people go, OK, you can play in that arena, because in order to laugh together, you are admitting that we are the same and that you've bonded, aren't you?
That's very insightful, Paul. It's that business of laughing together creates a sort of, it's a conspiracy in a way. You're recognizing something in each other. Absolutely. That's so interesting. Yeah.
Oh, I love the idea of it being a conspiracy. I'm not going down for it though, am I?
Oh, no, no. And I promise you, I was on the tube not very long ago, and I could feel somebody sitting to my left was looking at me. And so I turned around and she said, "Are you who I think you are?" And I said, and I hesitated for a minute, and I said, "Well, if you're thinking of killing your husband, I could be your woman." And can I tell you, it was so funny because all the folk, it was in the tube, and the folk around us were all suddenly interested in me as well. I could see them going, "Can I have your card?"
In your brilliant books, I mean, I recently read Miss Justice. And you talk about the way women present themselves has always mattered in court. Do you think that played into how women, because in my era of the comedy store, women found it harder to get a foothold in the comedy store? And it was the same in law, and it was the same in a lot of professions. I worked and still know well, and she's been on the show, Jo Brand. She was one of the only people who could get that foothold early. Now things have opened up a lot, but why was it so hard at the time for women, and still is to an extent?
I mean, I have a whole set of women friends who are comedians. I mean, Jo is a friend of mine too, Sandy Toksvig and so on. And if you get together, they'll say that often they had, Sandy as a gay woman says that she used humour in a way to help bridge any sense that people might have that she was somehow different. And so, and in the same way, I mean, Jo's stories about the starting days when people shout abuse at her and so on, she really was able to turn it on its head. And I know quite a number of women who are funny like that, and how they've made humour a thing of inclusion. And I think that's that thing that we're talking about, the bonding thing that humour can create and crossing divides. And it's interesting that so now, as people, it's that first step. Now you're finding more people from ethnic minorities being stand-up comedians and so on. There's a moment where to put yourself into that space would be too terrifying, but actually by taking the leap into it, you then break down so many barriers. And so, it really is an interesting thing. And the fact of so many Jewish comedians was about, the business of, I mean, humour is so great amongst the Jewish community. And many of my Jewish pals will say, well, part of it is that, you know, by self-mocking, self-deprecation can make it also be a bridging thing. And so it's an interesting thing for women. And of course, on the business of appearance and so forth, I mean, women are always struggling with this because there's always much more judgment made of women because of how they look, how they dress, how they appear. And I mean, I'm the first person who would tell you, I used to be representing women. And I remember I was representing a woman and she was up. She had, it was a homicide of a very abusive husband, a terrible husband. And in fact, she and the daughter were in the dock in relation to his death. And while she was in Holloway prison, she was knitting for everybody. And she was a great knitter, June. And she said to me, I've got a very nice sweater that I've knitted for going to the court. And she showed me the sweater and it was full of sparkles. It was wool that had silver threads in it and gold threads in it. And I said to her, I don't want you to wear that. It's a lovely sweater. I love it. But do not wear it in the courtroom because I wanted her there, you know, looking somber. I did not want her there as if she was going to a cocktail party. Anyway, but of course, all the women in the prison had wanted these sparkly sweaters. And so that had become her niche thing in jail. But, and prisons are another place where I have to tell you that humour is incredible.
It's a survival mechanism at that point, isn't it?
Totally. And often women who are in custody can make you weep with laughter about telling you the stories of stuff in prison. It's interesting. Although they're also very places that are full of pain and misery. But it is about survival, as you say.
So what makes you laugh?
I was just mentioning that I have a whole set of women friends who are comics, you know, as well as being hugely serious when you're with them too. But, you know, Sandy Toksvig is one of the funniest women alive. You should do her, Paul.
I know, Sandy. We used to do the Comedy Store Players together. We run into each other occasionally. I would love to do her. She is one of my favourite people and so quick.
So quick and so clever. And she's a lawyer who got away. I've always thought I must make a set of proofs about the ones that got away. So many people who studied law and then thought, I'm not going to have a life of this. And she was one of them. She did law at Cambridge. And Sandy is one of the cleverest people I know. I mean, she's so clever. But her wit is so fast. To have an evening with Sandy always leaves me feeling I've been to a spa.
Oh, the humour spa.
Yes, how about that?
Well, actually, don't know. It's a sideline for the Humorology Project. Is that you can go to the Humour Spa and come away feeling cleansed.
Yeah, but you know, you can really. There's something about having a night where you really laugh, and how good it makes you feel. It really does. Isn't the oxytocin or something? Isn't there some is stimulated by laughter, and that it actually makes you feel good?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I mean, the Humour Spa, where you'll get a comedy cleansing.
Well, you're the man to do it. If anybody can do it, you can.
Well, actually, it's not a terrible idea. We're going into partnership, Helena. OK, we'll start the first one in Glasgow.
Oh, yes. Yes, we've got plenty of opportunity there, definitely.
Brilliant. Helena, we've reached the point of the show which we like to call quickfire questions.
Oh, dear.
Uh-huh. Well, that's a lovely reaction. Oh, dear. It sounded like my granny. Oh, dear.
My children, you see, mock me because my mother used to say, oh, dear. And, you know, it's like Mrs. Doubtfire. And I would say, oh, dear.
No, it's lovely. It's lovely. You just talked about Sandy Toksvig, Joe Brand being friends, but who's the funniest business person or person in the House of Lords or barrister or judge that you've met?
Well, I was mentioning Gilbert Gray, who was one of the funniest barristers I've ever known. I have a great friend, Chris Salon, who's a King's Counsel, again, one of the funniest people, and his stories about being in the courtroom are hilarious. There a lot of criminal barristers are actually the wittiest and funniest that you can come across. In the House of Lords, George Foulkes, who's on the back benches, is a Labour peer. There are whole sets of people who are very funny and witty. Judges, Alan Moses is a very funny man and was a great Court of Appeal judge. And who then went on to run the Press Complaints Commission. Well, do you know that I was with Karen Brady yesterday, you know, who does the telly thing.
The Apprentice.
She's in the House of Lords now. But we were at a gathering yesterday. She can be hilariously funny. She's very good. Fiona Shackleton, a woman in the House of Lords who's a lawyer and a family lawyer. And she always says that when she came into the House of Lords, she said there were a whole lot of very, very wealthy men who suddenly saw her coming in to take her place on the benches. And they all thought, oh my God. And she's the woman who took the shirt off their backs when their wives sued them for divorce. And so, you know, there are some very, very witty, funny people in there.
You've just given me a lovely list of people who must be on future humorology podcasts.
Yeah, get them in, definitely.
What book makes you laugh, Helena?
I started immediately thinking more of, it was so interesting when you said what book. Films. I mean, for example, I have watched over and over again Some Like It Hot, and I still weep with laughter at Some Like It Hot. There's something about that whole business of Jack Lemmon and
Marilyn Monroe.
I think is just one of the funniest and best of humorous films. I worry about the fact that some of the films that I've loved most have been films about men dressing up as women. And I don't know what that's about, but in this world in which we're wanting to be much more inclusive, and I did the first trans case in an international court back in the 90s, I hope we don't get to a place where we don't think it's possible to laugh at. Do you remember, Tootsie? Tootsie's one of the most his films. Am I going to stop being able to laugh at Tootsie? I would really regret that. And indeed Mrs. Doubtfire and so on. Books. I'm trying to think of what book. I mean, on music, on a record, one of the funniest records that I ever heard was Tom Lehrer. Do you remember Tom Lehrer?
Oh, God, yeah, no. My friend Jackie Green in the States used to have when I used to go, she used to have an old record player and she grew up with the Tom Lehrer, and she used to play Tom Lehrer all the time to me. And just the use of language was so precise as well. I love a comedy song. You don't get enough comedy songs. Obviously, with my background with Morris Minor and the Majors and the Calypso Twins, I would love a comedy song. But I still love, things like Ernie. I thought was a funny comedy song, but Tom Lehrer was much more intellectually pure.
It's worth people going back to it, because I was introduced to it by somebody and by an American when I was probably 20, and it still it makes me laugh. But he was very, very witty. I'm trying to think of Howard Jacobson as a writer is a very, very funny man. And let me tell you, he always said, I was for a while the chair of the Booker Foundation, which gave the Booker Prize for literature. And I'd been on the board for a very long time. And I remember Howard won the prize, the Booker Prize. And he at the time said, I didn't think I could ever win the Booker Prize, because although I thought of myself as a literary writer, I couldn't stop myself being funny. And I didn't think that a funny book could win the Booker Prize. Well, he did win it with a very funny book. And his books are, while serious, are also hilariously funny. He's one of the writers that I think I know that I'm going to laugh while I'm reading his very fine novel.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
What I'm interested in actually is, isn't it, I just suddenly thought of the whole thing of the way humor isn't valued so much by society. You know, very few comedians get into the House of Lords, for instance. You know, very few comedy films win Oscars. And it's, you know, things, the humor isn't valued as much. It seemed as easy, you know. But I always think, you know, the drama is easy, comedy is hard.
I mean, that whole business of timing, of also knowing your audience, you know, the skills involved in that, I think, are considerable. And you're absolutely right. When does a comedy film win an Oscar? And you almost know when somebody is playing somebody who's been tortured or somebody who's had a, you know, terrible life, or, you know, that the darker the subject matter, the more likely the actor is to get their, you know, the best actor's award. And it's in some ways unfair because the skills involved in making people laugh are underrated. Not underestimated, because I think that we know how important it is, but somehow in the serious business of the arts, we don't give it the credit that it deserves.
My book, Humorology, which is not a plug, but it's just the byline is the serious business of humour at work. It is serious to get it right. Like somebody like Tom Lehrer that you're talking about, Howard Jacobson, it's a very serious art, and to get it right is much harder, I would say, than just to do something serious.
You should get Howard on, because he will talk to you about that whole business of how the world of literature and the book world is so sort of steeped in some of these prejudices. That to be a great writer, you know, that somehow you have to leave that behind, and I just don't think people are right. He's very good on that.
I want to take a shift to the other side, because I know so much of the amazing work you do is very serious. So the question I want to ask is, what's not funny?
I honestly think you can find humor in almost any circumstance, but it is interesting that some things are. Do you remember there was a film, and it was, I think it was an Italian film, and it was about being in the, it was about a man who was in a concentration camp, and his with his child.
Was it My Beautiful Life or something? It made me cry buckets. With the little child, and he pretends everything is a game so the child doesn't get affected by it. Yeah,
he tries to ameliorate the horrors of it all by using humor. And I remember having discussions with friends of mine about whether that was an acceptable thing to do, because some people said it was, you know, that somehow the Holocaust was totally taboo. And it was interesting because I thought the film was wonderful. For me, it was incredibly moving. In fact, the more moving because we knew about the horror. We knew that it was sitting alongside on that very tight wire. But some people really did feel that crossed the line. I don't like supposed humor for example, there are times when people think that they're being funny and they're really and they're really being cruel. I don't like it where somebody is seriously diminished, but I'm trying to think of examples of it. I mean, you remember that business where Trump thought he was being funny when he was talking about somebody who had a disability and who had cerebral palsy or something and had a shake, and he started mocking the person. And he thought that it was funny, and no doubt there were people in the audience who thought it was funny, but to most of us seeing it then, it looked so despicable. And so there are things that do cross lines. But I think even difficult subjects can be made humorous, but it has to be done with great sensitivity. But most really good comedians, people who use humor have very highly developed antennae as to what crosses the line and what doesn't. Anyone that I know who's really, really funny knows what will work and what doesn't, and what's cruel and what isn't.
Well, that's interesting though, but that humor has to walk that tightrope though, doesn't it? And sometimes you go over the line. Have you ever crossed the line in your own head and then had to pull things back?
Last night I spoke at a medical, I was asked by a friend to come and speak at a medical dinner. I did a report recently on diversity and inclusion, which was, for the Royal Colleges. This was for the Royal College of Surgeons. And it was to look at the fact that getting women into those top positions in surgery, it's a bit like the senior levels of the judiciary. There are not many women around. And you have to ask yourself the questions as to why that is. And I won't go into the whole serious business of the things that kind of sort of where women feel at early stages exclusion and therefore make choices that don't take them into those worlds where they know that it's going to be too painful. And so I had done this report for the Royal College of Surgeons, but last night I was invited to speak at this dinner, and I have to tell you that I would have said that the audience was 98% men, and quite a lot of my witticisms are around the business of guys getting it wrong, you know, or whatever. Or the business that I have acted for large numbers of women, not large numbers, but you know, in the scheme of things, I've done a lot of cases for women who killed their husbands, but usually after years of being abused and so on, where they eventually snap and they can't take any more. But for example, I have some jokes that I tell about that, you know, where I was doing, in the midst of doing this whole set of cases where women who had experienced violence and terrible treatment inside relationships eventually killed their partner, and so on, was trying to get the law of diminished responsibility, you know, provocation or whatever, to get it to work for women, which was hard because it was never designed with women in mind. And so I was doing these cases, a whole set of them. When you do a case and you get and you start moving the law and things, then solicitors start coming to you because you've got a layer of expertise. So you end up becoming the go-to person for a certain kind of crime. And so I was doing these cases, and one of the men in my chambers went into the clerk's room and said, "I've just seen the newspapers that Helena's representing a man that's killed his wife. I didn't know that she represented I didn't know she represented the guys that did that. And my clerk, who was a very acerbic woman, said, yes, she does, but she doesn't get them off. Which was not true, no, let me tell you.
No, but it's a great gag.
I mean, because it's a true story, of course. And I felt that there was that the response from the audience was not quite as warm as it is if I say that to a woman's audience, you know, or a, you know, they, but it's interesting. So I kind of had to, I thought, oh, I'm not going down that road anymore. I'll pull back on the husband jokes. Took it elsewhere.
Well, no, but funny is funny, as far as I'm concerned. I actually thought when I asked the question, the first words out of your mouth were going to be misogyny. But I suppose that if you approach everything, it's a funny. The joke you just told was, in inverted commas, anti-man. But it's you can make it funny. And if it's done with the right spirit, of course, then that's where humour comes in, is you've got to know that the person is coming at it with the right heart, do you not?
I make a point of saying to people, you know, there are not very many men that hate women. but when women are talking about misogyny, what they're really talking about is a sense of women being kept in their place. And so it's, you know, that's the thing. It's about, or a sense of male entitlement. And so it's rather different. It's not, you know, people hating, you know, Muslims or black people or whatever, or gay people, or, you know, I mean, it's not, there are some men that hate women, but it's not many, but there are men who feel that women should know their place and that women are getting too uppity and that women and it's categories of women that they don't like. They don't like, you know, bossy women or women that are kind of, you know, too assertive or all that sort of thing. And so you've got to try and define it differently. And I think that we're still having those sort of discussions in our society about just making sure that we're not finding ways of keeping women in their place.
Well, I think in the comedy world, I think that I think men were intimidated by funny women. I've known lots of very intelligent, very funny women who have found it incredibly difficult to get male partners because they are either successful or funny or witty. And the male ego, as this is a generalisation, obviously, can't take it.
I can't remember who said it, but somebody said, I think it was Margaret Atwood, said, the thing that women fear in relation to men is that they'll kill them. That you know, it's the business of greater physical force and all of that. The idea that and from being a child, girls are told, be careful, there are men out there who will do bad things to you. So what women, Margaret Atwood said, what women fear about men is that they'll kill them. What men fear about women is that they'll laugh at them.
Oh, yeah. What word makes you laugh?
Well, the idea of tickle makes me laugh. I mean, just the idea of tickle, things tickling you because it's amusing, or being tickled, or when I tickle my grandchildren. I mean, the whole business of tickling is such an interesting thing. Yeah. It's so ridiculous.
And you're laughing just at the word tickle. No, I like that because that, when it's tickle onomatopoeic, do you think? I don't know.
It is. But there is a sort of, isn't there a tickling?
I don't know. I've never heard it be onomatopoeic, which suddenly occurred to me that it probably was. And it was, but it also has a visceral effect, doesn't it? As soon as you say the word tickle, you start to move.
But things, of course, metaphorically tickle us because we're amused and stimulated and you know, energized or enervated by something. It's a nice word.
Yeah, lovely word. What sound makes you laugh?
Hearing my grandchildren laughing makes me really laugh. And it reminds, there is something wonderful about becoming a grandparent. My grandchildren are tiny. And of course, they're always, they find everything to do with weeing and pooing and so on. And just hearing them laughing in that completely uninhibited way, and they have no embarrassment about roaring with laughter. I love it, and it makes me laugh too.
Well, there is that statistic, isn't it, that children laugh between 300 and 400 times a day, but adults only laugh 17.5 times a day. And I've always wondered about this 0.5. What's it? Half a laugh? You know, you just described something earlier on when you said, you know, you get together with your friends like, you know, Joe Brand and Sandy Toksvig. Is that not part of your therapy? Because I do it. I have groups of people who I just know will make me laugh. And it is like therapy.
Another person like that is Kathy Late, you know, the Australian writer. She was married to one of the men in my chambers, Jeff Robertson, who's a very clever lawyer. And Kathy is great fun to be with. And I can honestly tell you, if I ever feel down in the dumps, she's one of those people that you can always rely on to make you feel good. And you know, I have great friends like that. And I have men friends like it as well. I mean, I was talking about one of my colleagues at the bar, Chris Salon. I mean, you know, who just, you know, that you'll laugh in their company because they're so amusing and funny.
Yeah.
Find that they get to that soft underbelly where you know that somehow, you know, even if things are rotten, they're not really, and we'll get through all of this, that sort of thing.
Yeah. Oh, it's beautiful. So the penultimate question is, you've got this extraordinary background and education. Would you rather be considered clever or funny?
Oh, I like the fact that I'm considered funny, honestly. I would like, you know, when it's they write on one's tombstone something, I do want witty or funny to be in there because I do feel it is part of who I am. Is that I'm good company, I think, because I have that capacity of not just being a rather serious lawyer. And it's very interesting. Somebody in the House of Lords once said to me, well, we invite you to lots of things, Helena, because you're very clubbable. And of course, clubbable, it sounds rather snooty and posh and grand, but clubbable means that, you know, I'm not tribal. I'm able to be friends with people across the political divides, and I have lots of friends on all sides of the House. And it's the same as being at the bar. You know, you fight a case and the prosecutor is on the other side and you can go at each other hammer and tongs, and afterwards it's all over. And I suppose I learned that early on in my profession. And so, I want to be remembered as somebody who was compassionate and warm and humane and funny.
Well, you are all of those things. Finally, desert island gags. You can only take one joke with you to a desert island. What is it?
As lawyers, we're often the butt of jokes. And usually it's about us being sort of, you know, avaricious and having no ethics and being appalling people. You know, what's the difference between a lawyer and a pit bull? Uh-huh. Jewelry.
Fabulous.
A judge once reported me to the head of my chambers. He said, could you have a word with Miss Kennedy? She wears too much jewellery in court.
Oh my goodness, yes, fabulous. You are wonderful. Thank you so much for spending the time with us on the Humorology podcast. You're not only clubbable, you are a great company and purely comedic. Thank you so much for being our guest today.
Well, it was lovely being with you. Really terrific.
The Humorology podcast was hosted by Paul Barros. Produced by David Rose. Music by Steve Hayworth. Creative direction by Les Hughes. And additional research by Helen Sykes. Please remember to subscribe, like, and leave a review wherever you get your podcasts. This has been a Big Sky production.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.